sugar. Pat, what's that satisfy? It's based on a teaching that the Pajamama first gave. Okay, it's based on a tradition, a teaching that has been around centuries. It's meditation using the two modes of meditation taught in the tradition, the sound that's taught, normal. It's concentration and an insight, the two. So, second, it's insight into the emptiness in particular. Right? Second, it's taught in the context, usually, of the Sutras Mahamudra and the Tantra Mahamudra. So it's usually taught as an advanced practice, and it's been around centuries, and it's part of a secret oral tradition over the centuries. And then in the 17th century, Pajamama first kind of articulated in this little text and the commentary on that text. And if it weren't possible for a beginner to do it, why would I talk about it? Okay.
Can you just talk a little bit about what the line that you said was the essence of Buddhism, when your emotions are strong, instead of focusing on the object or the situation or the person, focus on the mind itself.
Yeah, that's all, like from the very beginning when we were talking about the essence of what Buddha's saying is that the mind, what goes on in our mind, is the main cause of our happiness and suffering. Yes, there it is.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess just to unpack it, when in my situation, in my family, narcissistic father with my mother, 83 years old, developed her, even though she's a Christian, absolutely developed her compassion wing, but perhaps not the wisdom wing in leaving that situation. And
sorry, I'm a bit lost. Just tell me the facts and what you said.
Well, I understand what we've been saying before, but that just resonated with me really strongly when I came back in and read it, that particular line, and how to focus on the mind rather than the story and what's going on. And so what you're just saying is practice, and get away from the person or the situation intellectually. No, not intellectual.
The big picture point of view in Buddhism, the big picture, like we're saying, one way of framing all of this information is how to get free of suffering, how to rid ourselves of suffering and its causes. Okay. Okay. So let's look at the Four Noble Truths as the answer to this. So the big picture point of view. So the first, no, the first, actually the truth, these things aren't known. This is the way they phrase it. The truth or fact. They're good, both same words. I prefer the word fact. Soon you say the word truth, it sounds like religion. You know, so it's facts. I remember what I was saying, the Buddha from his own experience is saying what he's seen to be so is fact. Like any good science will tell you they've seen fact, because they show their methodology and then we have to prove it. That's the same here. So, fact is there is suffering. Second one is there are causes. The third is you can get rid of it. And fourth is how to do it. Don't say. That's an essence of these four. The four facts for the noble ones, basically. A noble one is a term in Sanskrit, Arya being, I think means superior being. A person who's gotten to a certain point and they've realized emptiness, they've cut the root of delusion, these are the words for it, and then they're out there on the way out of samsara into their own liberation from suffering. It's like a stage of development. Okay. So basically what Buddha's presenting is his own experiential finding about what suffering is. Right? And then the crucial one, of course, is the causes. And so everything's cause and effect, okay? Everything's cause and effect. And he has now nailed it down to two main causes. Two main causes of suffering. The first noble truth are three kinds of suffering. The first kind is, we actually talked about the second kind as well, but I never labeled it that, so I'll tell you now. But the first one is the simplest one to say. The first level of suffering, the root cause of suffering is suffering. Which is when the bad things happen. That's it. And our lives as we know it, we know that when we say we're suffering, it means when bad things happen to us. We get sick, people are mean to us, isn't it, basically? Generally when bad things happen to us. Without being complicated, everybody on this planet agrees that that's called suffering. Well, for the Buddha, that's called the suffering of suffering as the first. The second one, we actually described it before, was the suffering of change, which is when the good things happen, but that's rooted to attachment. We'll forget that even now, forget that one. And the third, even more subtle, is called all pervasive suffering. We don't even go there for now. So the first one, if we take that on board, we all agree there is suffering of suffering, he calls it that, and that's when the bad things happen. So, the normal worldview, without being taught anything by anybody, animals believe it, humans believe it, it's primordially instinctive to us, but if someone does something mean to us, we say they're the cause of our suffering, don't we? Very simple. Okay. So if you're angry with somebody, one, they're the cause of your suffering, and they're causing your anger too. They cause you to be angry, and they cause you to suffer. And that's wrong. So that's, we would take that for granted. We would never question that. No being on the planet questions that. And that, so then naturally that implies our solution, make the person change. Well, they've got to suffer, one or the other, isn't it? Mm. Pretty logical, based on that assumption. Well, Buddha happens to argue with that philosophy and says a load of rubbish. Mm. It's a fruit of this, all these delusions in the mind. From countless lifetimes, we have ego grasping, which causes us to have attachment, which causes us to have anger, and all of these views are a product of these delusions in our mind, that are these deeply held misconceptions in our bones for countless lifetimes, that have caused us to literally misconceive the way the world is. That's what he's literally saying. So, if we're taking on board Buddha's view as our working hypothesis, and we're attempting to use it in our daily life as our basis for changing our mind and bringing our minds into sync with his view, which is what our plan is, but it's hard because we're addicted to the other view, that's all. So it's hard, we hear the words, but it's hard because we're addicted to the other view, the view of the usual views. And rubbish, it's not my fault, I didn't ask to get born, it's his fault, blah blah. Okay, isn't it? So, then, what practice, so then we look at the second noble truth, let's say, you know, the boyfriend punches me. Something simple, ordinary. You get sick, I don't care what you call it, whatever it is. Person meets you in the shops, you don't get credit at the bank, whatever it is, the thing that happened we don't like, basically. That don't get credit at the bank. Okay, simple. You go to the bank, you think you've got the right qualifications, and you don't get credit. You get really hurt, upset. How dare they not give me credit? I'm qualified, I've got this, I've got that, I've got the bank, blah, blah, blah. We get upset, we get angry. That's normal, absolutely the most normal life in the world. Completely normal. So what's Buddha's analysis of it? Okay, it's this. In the second noble truth, he says there are two main causes of suffering. There are many, 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 many things that have to come together to produce anything, including a moment of suffering. But he pins it down, he narrows it down to two main things. And as far as we're concerned, there's one cause of our suffering, the mean bank guy, who doesn't see the truth. You understand? But as far as Buddha's concerned, there are two main causes of that suffering. Speaking simply, one is called karma, and the other is called delusion, and they're both me. We're not discussing the bank guy at all. Me. Me. They're both in me. So already that's a big shock, isn't it? So then how, so then what does that mean? So karma means action, and he's referring to an action I did in the past in this continuity of my consciousness. What everybody's thinking about, I think and do and say is an action, nothing goes astray, and everything I think and do and say is either a negative action, which is based on a motivated by a neurosis, a ridiculous state of mind, or a valid state of action, a positive action, which is motivated by a virtuous state of mind. Fundamentally, pretty simple principle. It's much more nuanced than that, but that's the principle. So if I'm taking this on board and I'm angry walking out the bank, what will I do with it? I've called it suffering. I don't want this to happen. I want credit. So my attachment didn't get what it wanted. That's the analysis from the point of view of the delusions. My attachment wants, as well as my valid part wants the credit. I'm going to pay for my children, you know. So, but the attachment is upset because it doesn't get what it wants. So I get angry. So then I want to work with it. So I'll go home, or I'll drive on the way home in a car. Now, if I don't know what the Four Noble Truths are, and if I don't know what karma is, I don't know what delusions are, except that I know the words, I don't know how to analyse it, do I? I've got to have some substance in my words. I've got to study it a little bit. Like I'm trying to work out what's the weed and what's the flower, I'm going to learn botany. So I've got to be working on it. How do I work on it? I'm fixated on the bloke in the bank. How dare he, this, he, he's not there. I'm on the bloke, isn't it? Natural, natural, natural. So how am I going to change the analysis? I have to sit down with myself, I've got to calm down, get a cup of tea, get it, whatever, and go through it. Okay, what I have to recognize, this is called suffering. Check. First noble truth, first kind of suffering, check. Just got it. Second, what's the cause? Go to the second one. Karma, bloody hell. What must have I done in the past? What I must have stolen from this person. They don't trust me. I must have, maybe I'm lying, I've stolen. Because that habit has gone into my mind, this particular person in person, and then program my mind, and then when they see me, they don't know that. They don't know that for a bar of salt. Vow of soap, whatever. But we've got karmic connection with a particular person. Maybe dealing with a bank and a particular person, because another bank manager might have been a maybe if that's my credentials. So it's pretty personal. So he doesn't believe my words, doesn't believe me, and doesn't want to trust me, or something like that. So it's two things. So I go, well, what's that? That's the result of what? Well, maybe he doesn't trust me. That's cool. I must have lied in the past. What a drag, you know? But I must have been not generous. I must have been stealing, because the result of not getting is not having given. So I take on board, I must have stolen or not been generous, and I must have lied. So then I accept that, I accept that responsibility, and the second cause of the suffering is the delusion that caused me to do that, which is self-centeredness or attachment or anger or whatever. So then I've accepted that, so then I work on that, and I think about that, and I try to think about the Four Noble Truths, and I think about karma, and I think about delusions, and I calm myself down. That's called practice. That's it, done. It just takes time. So we can fix by it. Because the belief I have now during the time of the practice, you know, the belief is so powerful instinctively, the view of ego grasping, the view of attachment, and the view of aversion, and the view of no karma. I'm an innocent victim, it's not fair, how dare you? That's the philosophy I've got in my mind, isn't it? Yeah. And that's deeply ingrained. So I'm arguing with that philosophical position.
Yeah.
That's what's called practice.
Yeah.
So if you want to say you're a Buddhist, you've got to know, you've got to input some words to what karma is. The first kind of karma is the second kind of this, the result of this, and therefore this is because of this. Otherwise, how can you argue with it?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So that's called Buddhist practice.
Yeah.
That's it.
Absolutely. I understand that, and I get that the description you've given exactly, but when it's someone else, like involving your mother.
Well, that's a different discussion. What's the question? You have to ask me the right question. You're asking the right question then.
No, that was the question. Oh, well, I was giving you that context.
It's about you or your mother.
It's about my mother.
Well, it's the same argument.
Yeah, it is. It's just a different
then
concept.
Then that's not your question.
Yeah, no, I guess.
Question.
Yeah, no.
You mean your question is how do you help your mum?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that your question?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that is the question. How do I help my mum when you're absent from her?
Do what?
To not be... not die badly. And I've read your manuscript.
What's your mum's problem? She's mad at her husband.
No, quite the opposite. No, that's what I said. She's developed the compassion wing.
What's wrong with
that? That's fabulous. But no, but the fact that she's been so compassionate and kind and forgiving of my father for their 60 years.
Excuse me, Lee, what's the problem with that? What's your problem?
Mum is incapacitated.
No, she's happy and got a compassionate mind. What's your problem?
No, she's not happy. She's in the last 6 months, she's in hell.
You just said for 60 years to be compassionate.
Correct.
But you now just say she's not happy.
No.
Well, I'm sorry, one of those is a lie. Because you can't be compassionate and not be happy. So
it's only in the last month. I mean,
just keep it simple and tell me the problem.
Okay.
As you
well,
see
2 years ago when I was sitting here...
I just need a simple description right now of what the problem is in this second, right now.
This second is that...
What is the problem?
That she just rang me and she said, never get to call me because my mother can't even dial the phone. She's in a nursing home in Queensland and my father is there and he's, you know, it's how I get the compassionate side of it.
I need you to please keep it simple and tell me the problem.
I guess what you said, how do you help your mum when you're away from her? When I've read the manuscript,
tell me the problem. What is the problem?
The problem is that she's been this compassionate,
kind
woman
problem?
All her life with a joy and a happiness in her heart. Now she's so crippled and so incapacitated and she's sad and keeps begging to die. You know, has asked me to give her the needle.
What's this got to do with your father?
He appears to be the cause of it, and he's sitting there.
Who says it's the cause of it? Honey, please don't need to narrow it down.
No.
Your mother's sick, and she's old, and she's incapacitated. Please, Lee, I've got to get clear here. I'm not trying to be brutal and mathematical.
No, I get it.
But I've got to give you time to answer my questions. So there's your mum. She's old, and she's sick. And she's incapacitated, is that right?
Well, she is sick, she's incapacitated. Her heart is good, she weighs 28 kilos.
Right, okay, she's sick and she's old.
Well, she doesn't, they can't give her a definition of her sickness that she has.
Lee, darling, I beg you to keep on track.
I've come in because of,
I know that.
Talking to her at the phone rang when I was in the Gompa.
I can't answer your question.
Yeah, so that's fine. I probably shouldn't have asked the question while I'm...
There's my question. Is she dying?
Please, you be quiet. I'm trying to talk to her. This is my job. Can we identify what you think the problem is, and then I can give you my opinion. What try and locate the precise problem. And it sounds to me, what you're suggesting is, the problem is that because your mother is very sick and in great pain, and, okay, is that first point, is that correct? Just please, I beg you to answer the question.
Yeah, well, so how do you...
I beg you, is that the answer? First of all, she's very sick. Is that correct? I will ask you.
If she was very sick, she would be dead. So the doctors don't say she's very sick.
I really beg you to... wait, just let me try and answer it. I'm sorry, I'm not going to be bullying you. Your mother's old and sick, is that right? Yeah, she can't do much for herself, is that right?
She can't do anything for herself.
Good, okay. So, please tell me about her mind now. Tell me about her state, and try and please keep it really simple.
Yeah.
Is she angry?
Her mind is troubled.
Is she angry, is she angry, resentful, bitter, unhappy, depressed, jealous, pointing fingers?
No.
Is she accepting her suffering? Does she have faith in God?
Yes, she has
faith
in
God.
But
she prays to God. She prays to God, and she has acceptance of God. Does she have a sense that when she dies, she'll go to heaven?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, then I would suggest she has that.
Yeah, and
Lee, I can't see a problem. Excuse me. You're the one who's got a problem. You're the one who's got the problem.
Okay.
You are having a mental breakdown because you feel hopeless, because you think your mother's in a bad way, and you blame your father. You're the one you've got a problem. So we're not discussing your mother here, we're discussing you. So then how about you do what you can with it? Meanwhile, your mother is one of 1 billion people on this planet every day who get sick and old and die. At least she's not freaking out. She's broke. She's sick and painful, but she's got something in her mind. So that what makes you think she won't die peacefully? What makes you think that?
That is exactly what I think, Rabina.
Why do you think that?
Because she is very troubled. She is frustrated.
What do you mean troubled? What is her trouble? What do you mean troubled? What do you mean troubled, darling? What do you mean troubled?
Her mind is not at peace.
What do you mean troubled?
Upset, worried, frustrated.
With what?
With the physical incapacitation.
That's natural, because you're sick and old and it's very painful.
It's extreme.
So she means she's angry. You just said she wasn't angry. But she must be angry.
She's heartbroken. She's not angry.
Well, that sounds like angry.
Okay.
Depressed.
Yep.
That's a version of the delusion. So she said she has faith in God. And she prayed. But but she has a sense that she'll be peaceful after.
Absolutely.
Well then
please love
her for who she is. Speak on the phone. Don't get distracted. Tell her she's amazing. Praise her for what
she's done. I've been doing that for years.
Good.
You know, I did that when I brought her back from overseas
What more can you think of that you could do to help your mother? Just be practical now. What more can you do? What more?
I've done everything.
What more could you do?
Nothing.
Okay, good. That's it. That's right. Let's not be brutal, but this is our problem.
I get it.
This is our problem. You know? And let you have compassion for your father. He's the one to worry about. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He's the one to worry about. So love who she is and ignore your father and just stay focused on her, please. Instead of getting so distracted and guilty and fearful, that's your problem. We're all the same people because you love your mummy. But focus home in on what's good there. Old age and sickness and death, we know, is reality. You can't escape that. You can't make that go away. You can't stop your father from being who he is.
No.
You love her for who she is and adore her and love her and give her lovely words on the phone and make her feel better. And don't be afraid of her distress. Don't be afraid of her upset and her distress. You are completely freaking out about it. You're the one who's got a problem here, not your mother and not your father.
Therefore, stay
focused on what is appropriate. Do what it says in the meditation. And stay focused on what is necessary, which is your mum.
Yeah.
And love her who she is and bring her as much as you can. And tell her how wonderful and how kind and what a wonderful person. That what I'm saying is, you ask me a question, I'm trying to answer you.
Yeah.
Don't keep saying no, because if you know you wouldn't ask me. We've now narrowed down finally the problem, which is your mind and your distress because you can't cope with seeing the suffering. That's your problem. That's your attachment. And that's your aversion. So get clear who's got what problem. You keep saying you understand.
I do understand. And like you've said to me, we had discussed this before.
It is hard work. You're right. I do understand.
You call everything but the right problem. That's why I keep pushing and pushing and pushing to locate the problem.
It's just being so far away.
That's got nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You have a telephone. She hears your voice in her ear. You love her for who she is.
Absolutely.
Well, then that is the answer, Lee.
Yeah.
Don't get distracted by all that stuff. It's what you're doing.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. Just my opinion.
Yeah. No, I get it. I appreciate it.
Back into the room, it's all empty, but anyway, we're going to go home. So this is the one, okay, let's talk about compassion here, okay. This is the topic, it's actually there. So we've got the delusions, we've got the attachment and the fears and the anger and the jealousy and the loss of esteem and misery. So the Buddha's saying, these are the source of my suffering, and actions done on the basis of these in the past have set me up for my present suffering. I mean, these words you might have heard for 40 years, but it still is so hard to even hear them, and so shocking if we haven't heard it before, or if we haven't heard it before, because it's utterly against the philosophical view that we have deeply in our bones now. And this is the point, you see, we think that when we get born, we start to think things automatically, we assume things automatically. So my mother didn't have to teach me to be angry. So the moment my attachment didn't get what it wanted, I programmed myself in that, so automatically anger would come. Another child, like a little boy crying with compassion for the lice, that was his programming. But we don't think of it that way in our culture. We just see a person how they grow up, and it's natural. That's how it is. Even by natural, they're just at second nature. Well, what's second nature is what we've practiced before. So this is really the approach in Buddhism. We've got to really do this kind of unpacking of the assumptions deep in our bones. So attachment and anger are just deep, primordially, deeply held assumptions. They're actually, if you unpack them, they're a philosophical position. The philosophical position of attachment is this primordial, junky insistence that I get every second what I want. We are born with it. Our mummy does not teach us this. And then aversion is the response when it doesn't get what it wants. These two, if we can even minimally understand these and understand the philosophical position that these are, if we unpack their assumptions, unpack these assumptions, and start to look, and then this drive gets us to the root one, the ego grasping, this assumption. this assumption, this deeply ingrained assumption of a real, solid, concrete, definite, absolute, self-existent, inherent, intrinsic I. This is the real one. So just the analysis of these three would be in years of retreat, you know, doing this. Because this is the basis, the Buddha says, of suffering and its causes. Of course it's an outrageous view. We never think this. We just think somebody else is the cause of my suffering. I mean, right there, complete logical suffering in father, but then he's the cause of this. Like a complete nonsense. It's another discussion altogether. And then, of course, the one that passed karma is even more abstract. We can say the words, oh, yeah, it's all karma, you're so cute about it, you just spout out words. What good is that? We don't know how to unpack the words and define them and be precise. What kind of karma is it? What happened there? What happened there? You know, do the analysis as a to counteract these assumptions. This is what daily practice is doing. That's only if you choose to be a Buddhist. No one's forcing you. So on the basis of this, we will become more contained, more clear, more confident, more content. This is literally, I'm trying to be literal here. I'm trying to give you literal technical descriptions of things, not just cute words. This is literally the result of this kind of practice. Because you're reconfiguring your assumptions. And you're fundamentally changing your views. So you become less fearful, less panic-stricken, less depressed, less angry, less anxious, more wise, more confident, more clear, more content, more fulfilled. That's the wisdom way. The result of this just for you is sublime. But we have to practice it seriously, not pretend we're practicing. You have to know the words. You have to know the words. Because the words are expressions of thoughts. And we live at the level of thoughts. So like we're seeing here with the Mahamudra practice, there's many approaches to practice. You've got to sometimes look like you're doing here a brutal kind of analysis. Another time, if you're overwhelmed by your stuff, you just simply sit down and observe the clarity of your mind in such a space. And they all help each other. You all need to know what to do when. Sometimes you just want to go to sleep, best method. Sometimes you do this brutal discussion with yourself, another method. You've got to know what you need at different times out of your toolkit. Do you understand? Mm. At different times. Mm. This is the wisdom of it. But you're exactly what you're talking. Unless we've done this, we can't know how to help others. So even for me, I'm not to be horrible, but using it as an example, you expose yourself, so I have to use the example. It was like 10 times, 15 times I had to ask you to try, even look at what the hell you're talking about. Because you are emotional about it. And I understand that we're all the same. But I couldn't work out whether your father did something, your mother did something, you did something. I mean, it took a while to locate these, to put it down on the earth, do you understand? So now what we see is, the problem is yours. Because you can't do a single thing for your mother except be loving and kind, which is yours. That's compassion. So that's why I asked the way I did. Because I was assuming you're talking about yourself, your own anger. But you weren't. You weren't at all. So that means the job is about compassion. So what does that look like? How does that seem? And that's what I answered you. When we located the problem, then your job is to help your mother and love. You can't take the pain away. You can't make her change after 60 years. You can't make your father not be the way he is. You can't take away her distress and her depression and her whatever words you said and her 28 kilos. You can't. And that's what's distressing you. So that's where, if you're overwhelmed by your own attachment, and why we suffer is because of our own attachment, and you've got aversion to this, and that's why you're suffering, then how can you help your mother? Mm. Then you get all lost and confused and do the wrong things. So when we are more stable and more content and more wise and more clear, and if we're using the Buddhist analysis, just taking the view here, then we will know immediately that now I can help my mother. You can see her distress. You understand death and impermanence. You know it's the way life is. There are what, millions right this second, people dropping dead each second of the time we're talking here, based on old age, suffering, dementia. So that's the key thing. Then you have to check home you and your mother. What can I do for your mother? You ring her as many times you can in the day. She's got a mobile phone with her, has she? Or not?
She has, but she can't use
she can't
her hands.
Pick it up.
Her hands are contracted.
Well, then okay, the nurses in the hospital have to have it on open, or does she have people around all the time?
You have to go through the nurse to get the nurse to do that.
Okay, that's fine.
So
you do that.
You call 10 times to do it, and I do
okay,
that. You call 10 times.
Okay,
to speak
good.
To
you do exactly that, and you just talk to your own.
And that's precious, you know, a few minutes.
No, don't keep talking. You want me to help you? I will help you. But just don't act like you know all the time, Lee. Otherwise, you don't understand.
No, I'm just telling you how what it is, how it's not as simple as just calling.
Okay, I understand, Lee. So I'll change the subject. I'll leave you alone. Because it's not going in at all.
No.
No, it's what I'm trying to say to you. Huh? I'll keep going. Let's talk about compassion. So if we work on our lives and what we're doing, then we can see more clearly. This is the point about the wisdom. If I'm overwhelmed by my, not from you now, but I'm overwhelmed by my dominion, my attachment, my anger, my fear, my anxiety, my jealousy, it is completely evident I can't see past my own nose. It is completely evident. Even if I'm really attached to food and I'm frantic to get food all the time, I'm so distracted to get the food I want, I can't even see the person next to me what they want. That's the distress of our own mind. That's why we have to learn to see so deeply into our own mind. When we're overwhelmed by our own stuff, that's what makes us completely self-centered. I'm trying to be critical. Because we're frantic to get that food, frantic to get that cigarette, frantic to get that junk, frantic to do the thing that will calm us down. I mean, this is what attachment, ordinary attachment. I'm not saying you have to be a junkie or a pedophile. I'm talking about ordinary suffering. When we're so overwhelmed by our own neediness, when you're hungry, and all you can think about is the food, all you can think about is the food, and your bloody mother's on the phone, and you wish you sharp, but all you want is your food. This is ordinary attachment. This is not like junkie alcohol attachment, or heroin attachment, or raping somebody attachment. Ordinary attachment. Our mind is overwhelmed by our own needs every second. We are overwhelmed and distracted by our own fears, our own dramas, our own world. And we can't cope with anything. And we then certainly can't help anybody else. So as long as Dalai says, compassion is the point. But compassion is not enough. Because we'll be dragged down to hell. We don't know how to help. We have to have wisdom. Wisdom is not some fancy phrase. It's what we get as and when we lessen attachment, lessen anger, lessen the chaos, lessen the berserk mind. Wisdom is what comes. So you are able to get out of ourself and put our own needs aside, even for a minute, and see the needs of the other person. Then that's the beginning of compassion. And not seeing them through the lens of our fears. So one of the things that is the commonest one in the world is this idea of like using your mother as a good example, Lee. You love your mother. You love your mother. You want your mother to be happy. And you can see her intense suffering. You can see the pain. And you can see you can do nothing to alleviate it. You can see that. Mm-hmm. So why we suffer because of that is not because of compassion. Is not because of love. You cannot suffer having love and compassion. Not possible. Absolutely, utterly, and completely impossible. We suffer because our attachment is not getting what it wants, which ever created to be lovely. And so we go, and it's so much pain for us, and then we get angry or depressed or distressed. That's why we suffer. That's why you're suffering. You're an example. That's exactly why you're suffering. You're not suffering because of your father. You're not suffering because your mother's old and sick and 28 kilos with twisted hands. You're suffering because you've got attachment and aversion and our own panic and fears and anxiety. That's what destroys us and that's what prevents us from helping other people. So if we're a mother, let's say, so in such a good example, a mother has unbelievable love for her child, unbelievable compassion, but we never see and look at or pay attention to her attachment to the child, which is completely separate from love for the child. Attachment for the child is this intense over-exaggeration of their deliciousness, this incredibly powerful kind of connection, and this enormous attachment to this person that we think about day and night. So that attachment completely blinds us from seeing the reality of the child. We can't see their mind. We can't see past our own nose. So then mothers will do anything coming from attachment to protect their child, but it doesn't mean it's coming from wisdom or compassion at Mums can be the most insanely wrong people when it comes to doing something for their child, because it's complete instinctive attachment to protect them, but it might be the worst thing possible, it might be the least wisdom possible. So you cannot have wisdom without calming our minds down and controlling our minds, understanding it, and we cannot act validly with compassion until we have more wisdom. So when you have wisdom, that means you have less attachment, less anger, less anxiety, less depression. Then we are much clearer, and then we can get ourselves out of the equation and see the person for who they are and know exactly what's best for them. And we would not suffer. We have compassion. And compassion isn't suffering. Don't think it is. If you're crying with compassion to somebody, you're not suffering. If you're crying because of attachment and panic, yes. We don't see the difference. We don't even know how to distinguish these in ourselves. And that's how subtle this stuff is, you know. Talk about video therapists. It's hugely meaningful. So the working on your own mind is the basis of your contentment for your fulfillment as the basis of your capacity to help others. That's absolutely clear. Whether it's helping your mouse or your mum, or your child. You know. So it's huge.
What's forgiveness in Buddhism?
Forgiveness. That's a really good point, Justin. Okay. But I think you might need to have a word for it. The emphasis is, this is why it's a very different kind of structure. So let's say actually. I'll try and describe it. Yeah. So, first of all, I think in our culture, this intense emphasis on forgiveness is an amazing quality. It exists, there's no question. But the Buddha's emphasis on this one, compassion. So the logic of compassion is this, and this is where I'll go through it slowly. So, well, I've sort of done already. So if we take, if I was a Christian, for example, a Catholic, naturally, because God is the creator, God is my boss, I have faith in God, so I want to do God's will. That's what being a Catholic and being a Christian means, because God's the boss. That's the crucial point, like I said before, a sin is doing what God said not to do. And it's quite a powerful meaning. So I want to do God's will. I do not want to go against God's will. So then when I do something wrong, I was going to talk about purification tonight, we can do that. So let's say the Christian way of purification is I would acknowledge that I have done something wrong, and then I would beg God to forgive me. And I'm not being sarcastic in the slightest. This is perfect. And the point is there, it's God's forgiveness that purifies me, that washes away the mistake. So let's put this into ordinary life. Use the same relationship, because that's powerful in our culture, to forgive, you know. So, of course, the Christian reason to forgive is because God is in everybody. But if we just forget the Christian one, but that philosophy of forgiveness, in other words, if I'm in my relationship with Fred, and I keep bad-mouthing him. So what happens is I'm bad-mouthing, I get impatient in the morning, I'm rude to him. Then I'm driving to work, I'm feeling all this guilt. And this is really, when I go to the purification practice, you understand that guilt is this neurotic, I-based, give anger against me. I did this, I did that. It's not articulate always, and it's the shame and guilt that somehow I did something wrong. So it's aversion for myself. It's anger towards myself. And it's a really common thing we have in our culture. We somehow really believe I'm bad. And this is the one, I mean, the Christians have an amazing saying, you know, they say, don't criticize the sinner. Don't criticize the person. I won't say the sinner, I'll say the mistake. So ourselves, the same. So, okay, I'm now talking about, I'm going to come slowly, Justin. The Buddhist approach to purification is a good way to remember is the four R's. And it's related to Buddhist karma. So, given the Buddhist view that I'm coming from the past, I'm programmed with my own tendencies, my own positive qualities, my good qualities, that I'm the creator of myself, this is who I produced from the past, and then I start to look into, I look at the end of the day, and I bad mouth creating it again. So, you know, and I'm feeling all this kind of, okay. The first one is called regret. The first step in this process, the four R's, regret, reliance, the remedy, resolve, it's in your book, I'm pretty sure. Yeah. There's no trauma that can't be purified. Page 27. It's all there. So, I sit down at the end of the day. Lama Dhamma said we're insane not to do this practice every day. There's very formal ways of doing it in the meditation. There's also a way just to do it casually with yourself. And I like to think about this process as like a kind of being your own friend. It's quite powerful. Well, it sounds sort of simple and useful. So regret is the first one. So one person asked the Dalai Lama one time, what's the difference between guilt and regret? And it's really a very precise difference. So guilt, one that we instinctively have, that says, as the Dalai Lama put it, if you look in the past, I did this, I did that, I did this. And then we conclude automatically, I'm a bad person. That's the brutality of guilt. So that is exactly the same as anger. If I'm mad at Fred, you did this, and you did that, and you did this, and then we conclude you are a bad person. So this is the key factor of all these neuroses in Buddhist psychological model. All these unhappy states of mind, like I said, have a particular function of being very disturbing and painful, very grief-stricken, but they have this particular function of exaggerating. They embellish. So, I did this, and I did that, and I did that. That's three things, let's say, I did. But what guilt does, which is internalized anger, is paint the whole of myself with that one brush and then say, I am bad. Well, speaking technically, it is just not logical. It's clinging to this intense neurotic sense of a concrete self, and because I did three bad things, or 10, or 20, that paints the whole of me as bad. Well, it's literally not true. So that's where this power, the wonderful saying the Christians have, don't criticize the person, yourself. Criticize the actions. So that's what regret is. Regret is this, well, this isn't a casual English word, but how we define it. You look at the past, just like with guilt. Well, I did do that, and I did that now, Fred, and I did steal that money, and I did do that. You own it. You know, instead of wriggling out and trying to get off the hook or trying to blame someone else or whatever, or having guilt, we own the fact that I did do it. Accept the fact. No more and no less. Don't exaggerate it. And then you train to think, instead of, I'm a bad person, you think, what can I do to fix it? What can I do to help? What can I do? Because saying I'm a bad person, there's no action that can come from that. It's just this overwhelming self-loathing. We suppress it. I mean, so much of what we do since we're children, bad things happen. And we have this tendency as ego grasping. One of ego grasping's function is a very strong grasping at a certain sense of I, very subtle, a deep gripping at a certain sense of a concrete me. And then immediately we do something, especially if the world thinks it's wrong. And because the deepest attachment we have is other people's approval, and all this happens like in a millisecond, then we assume because I did something wrong that I'll be criticised, so then we criticise ourselves. And that's this process of guilt. And then because we know it's naughty, we hate it. This is the worst pain, the worst suffering. We either blame someone else immediately, which is kind of volatile anger, that was my style, or we have guilt, which is blaming me, or we have denial. Because we can't bear the pain, so we suffocate. We don't even notice that 40 years later it all comes out. And we all do any variation of those. And these are the natural, instinctive responses of the ego grasping the primordial mistaken sense of a concrete I, then this huge attachment to be, and this particular attachment to be seen as a good boy or a good girl. It's very deep in our bones. We all the time are adjusting our behaviour to make sure that we're seen as a good person. And if we do something the world does not approve of, that immediately we feel like we've done the wrong thing, and so we have it, we turn to inwards and I become a bad person, and then we hide it. It's so monstrous to ourselves. It's so painful. So, if it's a sin, if it's a negative action, let's say, with Fred. So it's about we misuse forgiveness now. So if I'm a Catholic, if I'm a Christian, if I do acknowledge that I did something wrong, then I'll turn to God and beg God to forgive me. But the reality is, if someone's, you know, often we get guilt because people harm us, we put it onto ourselves. That's one common thing that many people do. If you're a naughty girl, I made mummy unhappy, I must be a bad girl. But maybe mummy's just neurotic. Maybe mummy's just angry. You did nothing wrong at all. And this is something, I'm getting to forgiveness, I promise. One of our worst attachments, not just to sex and drugs and rock and roll, the deepest, most primordial attachment is this craving to be approved of, since we're born. So let's say you've got a neurotic monkey who gets angry easily. 1 minute she laughs at you and thinks you're the cutest thing, so you feel like even this instinctive part of our attachment when we're a child, we feel happy because mummy's smiling at us. That must mean I did the right thing. The next time I do the same thing, but today she's angry and she hits me. Well, no wonder we're confused. Because you tried it out yesterday and mummy was happy, and now she hits me. So naturally, we assume because mummy's angry, mummy's behaving badly, we assume I caused it. This is the commonest mistake we all make. We own someone else's problem. We did nothing wrong at all. But this is what ego does. It's so tragic. Ego causes us to think I did something wrong because that person behaved badly. It's too shocking for words. But this is the way ego works, you know. So we turn it brutally against ourselves. It is so shocking. So anyway, that's one thing. So this regret is not that. Yes, I did badmouth Fred, so I'm trying to be honest with it, that I would then, so in this process, what we do is we acknowledge I did something, you acknowledge it to yourself, basically. And then you say, I regret that, and you've got to spell it out, instead of just being like, you know, why, say to myself, why do I regret badmouthing Fred? Well, because you know what, I don't want to keep badmouthing, it's an old habit, it harms me, it creates a cause for me to suffer in the future. This first step is like the one of compassion for yourself. But it's very hard to have that because we have guilt instead. I'm a bad person. So if I've got mainly guilt, what I'm also terrified of is that Fred might reject me. I think I'm feeling so bad because I hurt Fred, but really ego is freaking out because Fred might reject me and I can't bear to not be approved of. So I'm going to ring up Fred and I'm waiting on the end of the phone and I say, I'm so sorry, Fred, I didn't mean to harm you. And I do want to have compassion, but I'm mainly concerned that he might reject me by attaching my object what it wants. I have a panic attack. Please forgive me, Fred. And he'll say, oh, Lavinia, I still love you. And I'll be so relieved I've got off the hook again. So we misuse forgiveness to make us feel better. It's excellent to ask Fred to forgive me, but he's really been a wise boyfriend. He would say, Lavinia, I do forgive you, I do love you, but you can't just keep asking me to make you feel better. You can't just ask me to get you off the hook by forgiving you. You better make some decisions to change. And then they can agree with it. That's profound. But we often misuse forgiveness between each other. And the fact is the Buddha's view. So in the Buddha's view, the first step is regret. I own what I've done. Then if I'm brave enough, like what I've done today, then I think of the things I've done in this life. So for example, I had an abortion when I was 23. I always think of that one, because in the way I think now, that was a sentient being. A consciousness came into my womb at the time of conception, and then I decided to do whatever, based on my own ignorance at the time. So I don't hate myself because of it. I don't ever have guilt because of it. I don't have guilt. I don't have guilt much. I have anger instead. I often have guilt. You know, which is how I am. So I acknowledge I did that out of ignorance. I remember the moment I got pregnant. The second I was with this guy in bed, I knew I got pregnant. Oh no, I thought I'm pregnant. And that thought, I thought I'd have an abortion. All I knew was I didn't think it was a human being. I just knew what came out the other end is what I didn't want, which is a person, you know. I didn't want it. It was crystal clear. Never mind going into detail. So I always regret that one. I say, and I regret what, and I say to myself, why did I regret? Because I sowed a seed in my mind from killing somebody, that unless I pull it out, it'll lighten in the future as my suffering. I don't want suffering. So that's the logic of regret. And they always allow me to use the analogy of eating poison. So if I sat there and ate poison by accident, and Justin points out it was poison you did, Ravina, I won't go, oh, I ate poison, I was such a bad person, and then hide it all. That's insanity. I will think, oh my God, Ravina, I can't believe it. I didn't realize it was poison. What can I do about it? That's the second step, reliance. So this is where we get into the relationship with the Buddha, if you think of a relationship. The relationship is more like with a doctor. So if I'm a Christian, I would have gone to God, I beg you to forgive me, and God's forgiveness will purify me. That's exactly the logic of Christianity. That does not exist in Buddhism. He's not a creator. Of course he'd forgive me, he's a nice bloke. But it's not his job. It's like going to the Buddha, it's like going to the doctor, because I've eaten too much sugar. Please forgive me for eating sugar, doctor. Please purify my diabetes. By forgiving me. That's laughable. She's a doctor. She's wise. She will give me advice that I, and medicine, or methods to use, and advice. I am my own doctor. I will purify myself. So I rely upon the Buddha. But I will use those methods to clean, to purify me. And the first step is the regret. That's already part of the purification. Changing my mind. Owning it. And regretting it because I'm sick of suffering. So that's not compassion for yourself. So the next step, the refuge one, it relies. And then the second part is now you have compassion for those you've harmed. So it's like you're regretting for their sake. Fred, I know it's like you're bad now, so of course I have compassion for him. So now I regret for his sake and for anybody else I've harmed. I think of the baby I killed and other people. So I have compassion for those I've harmed. And I must purify for their sake. First, it's for my sake. So this process, when we talk about compassion, there's no concept of forgiveness yet. There's no concept, but it would come. So let's put it like this. If I've got this understanding of karma, that all these countless sentient beings, I've loved you in countless times, we harm each other, we all help each other, life after life after life after life. You know, let's say someone, you know, I say, you know, in my case of my father said he didn't behave such a good father, he was such a good father, did bad things that daddy shouldn't do, never mind the details, doesn't matter. That's been very easy for me. Even as a child, I knew my father was, for some reason, I knew my father was suffering, even though he harmed us, his children, you know. I know that. I always had a sense that he was suffering. And I was kind of easy to have compassion for him. I'm sort of lucky in a way. It wasn't too hard for me to have compassion for him. Because I could see that he was suffering. And what suffering means is he was caught up in his delusions that caused him to harm us. And that's why if I can see in my mind and see when I ever hurt anybody, if I ever hurt anybody, it's not because I'm blissful and loving and compassionate and patient and joyful. It's because I'm neurotic and attachment and needy and jealous and angry and fearful. So it's a question of degree, isn't it? So when I can own that in myself, I can have compassion for myself. If you like, I can forgive myself. In the first one, I regret that from the depths of my heart. Why? I say to myself, because you know what, honey, you know what, Regina, I'm sick of suffering. So you're purifying the causes. Then I turn to the doctor and take the medicine as the antidote, or this process is the medicine, to purify, and I have compassion for those who harm me. And if I'm brave enough, I will then think of those who harm me. Sorry, those I've harmed, and I'll have compassion for them. And then if I'm brave enough, if we're not brave enough, we don't go there yet, you have to know where you're at. Then I'll think of my father. I'll think of those who harmed me, the people, the guys who raped me one time, other little things that have happened, you know, in your own life, people who harmed you, your boyfriend who cheated on you, your sister who was mean to you. People who harm us. But this is based on what you can't, so it takes time. So the question is, why should I have compassion for the person who harmed me? It's logical, because they are full of delusions. Yes, maybe stronger delusions than mine. Maybe are maniacs. Maybe they're evil. There's no doubt about that. There's no question about that. That friend on death row who thinks of torture all the time. I see the guy. I can see him. And I know his mind. As he's sitting there, listening to my teachings, his mind is thinking about torture. Because that's the deepest primordial habit in his mind. Not just attached to eating cake, but torture. I'm glad he's there out of the way, because the guys on death row won't let him talk to them. I'm not happy he's on death row for the poor thing, but clearly he's harmed lots of people. So at least, like a wild dog, you know, you're prevented from harming others for the dog's sake. You put a chain on the neck of your cat, stop from killing the mouse for its own sake. So for his own sake, I'm relieved that he's not harming other people, although his mind's tortured. So when we know our own mind first, and our own delusions, and we realise we're all on this planet in the same boat, according to this way of seeing the world, then I can afford to understand my father's mind, or anybody else's harming me. And it's not easy if you're full of rage and hurt. When we're ready to do this, then I can have compassion for that person. Because why? As young Tibetan monks, I always quote the story of Richard Gere. In 2003, as you know, he's a Buddhist, and he invited all these 20 former prisoners. We were working out how to work on the prison things together, you know. We did his own thing eventually. So he invited 20 former prisoners to this talk the Dalai Lama gave. He invited the Dalai Lama to New York. So these 20 former prisoners, all of them had done some kind of meditation in prison. And for people like me, were in touch, we were working with people in prison. It was a very interesting day, all these black, white, Puerto Rican, male, female Americans, you know, all with their own suffering, their own dramas. Yes, and real suffering. Being in prison in this nightmarish environment in America. And then met the Dalai Lama. It was wonderful. You know, had a lovely day. So he also invited two young Tibetan nuns. So, you know, Tibetans are 99% Buddhist. Now it's all changed because, you know, it's overrun by Chinese communists. Now it's completely changed the face of Tibet, whatever. But basically, these Tibetans, you know, they're 99% Buddhist, and these young women, which is the tradition there, they're brought up as little Buddhists as they're born. And so the view of karma and reincarnation is in their bones, like the material that is in ours. It's their worldview. It's just how it is. And they buy into this, and it's the basis of their practice. That's why they don't have much anger. The Dalai was always saying that as the Tibetans got more and more in the West, they got more anger, and it made them very sad. Tibetans don't have much anger, and there's logic to that. Because what does anger say? Anger says, how dare you do that to me? I don't deserve it. And that's the philosophical position of the innocent victim who didn't ask to get born, was made by mummy or daddy, thrown on this planet, plonked on this earth. Nobody consulted me, remember? I didn't get consulted. Why we make you, Rebecca? Why we give you anger and jealousy and neurosis? No one consulted me. They plonk me on this earth, and then they say I've got to take responsibility. I think it's insanity. I think it's fascism. I think it's madness. I know I sound ridiculous talking this way. But that's the view we all have in the world. So of course we have anger. If I've never met this person, you know, these young women, let's say they weren't angry, let's say they were, they'd never met these they were tortured and sexually abused by these Chinese guards, you know, for a couple of years or something. Never met them before. So of course you'd say, how dare you, this is me, I don't deserve it. I've never met you before. Why should you harm me? I never met these guys who raped me in Spain 30 years ago, or 40 years, 50 years ago, something, I forget, 90 years ago, something. I say that, but it's not fair, because in the end I came out top line, so I really feel sorry for the guy. So never mind, it's not really that rape. It was always, but it wasn't. I came out boss. No one knew because it's too gross. Never mind. But the guys ended up, never mind. Doesn't matter. Okay, so. Okay, so. Where was I? So these young women, they were telling that they weren't angry because they don't have it. They have the view of karma, you see, in their bones. It's their view of reality. So there were tears, but they weren't angry. There's not anger there, because they don't have the view how they do that to me, because they know why it's happening, they have the view of karma. And that takes a while for us to hear, because we're so shocked by this view. That's normal for them, it's completely their culture. They've been for 1,000 years, you know, more than that, 1,200 or something. For everybody. Deeply entrenched in that view, and they study it, and learn it, and apply it, and practice it. So, they were sad, and one at the end was tears, you know. And probably I think the Americans probably thought if you want to quantify suffering, these two young women's suffering was more than everybody else had put together. But it was interesting just to have the communication, you know. But this young woman, one of them, sad tears, and she said, and of course we had compassion for our torturers. Because we knew we must have harmed them in the past. And because we know they will suffer in the future as a result of their actions. So that for me is not impossible. A mother, you know, pedophiles have mothers, wackos have mothers, psychopaths have mothers, and we all know mummies take a lot not to love their baby. And my feeling is, if you're not a psychopath or a pedophile, just you're a crazy kid, everyone else can't stand you. But she, her heart breaks for you because she can see that you are harming yourself. That's compassion, you know. So when you have a view of karma, if you take it seriously, you know that everything that happens to you, all the good as well, is because of your own past actions. So you learn to own those, and that really helps you shift your whole view about everything. You become more responsible, more accountable, more compassionate to yourself. Then you open your eyes and see the world. And you know it's exactly the same as the entire planet. And you see all the maniac beings harming each other and being harmed. And Buddha would say it's life after life after life, we're just repeating this insanity, always continuing to blame everybody else. But the fact is, this is where compassion, we have a very different definition in our culture. Our view of compassion, which gives rise to forgiveness, is based upon the concept of an innocent victim who didn't ask to get born, who unfairly meets that wretched person, and the monster who harmed them. So our logic, our philosophy, we don't analyse it like this, but analyse it and we'll see it's true. There has to be an innocent victim. If you've discovered, you know, like, this is a really funny example, I'm going to use it. When I was a radical feminist, years ago, before I was a Buddhist, and I was a serious radical feminist, and one of my things was, if any man said anything to me in the street, which they did then, because it's much more than now, because it was not even then, it was considered no problem then. People all the time, you know, whatever, say something about your body, you know. So my philosophy was, as soon as any man said anything about me, and I had a very nice chest, I was quite nice looking, apparently, I was in photos, I was okay. So then I would walk up to them really loudly in the street, and I did it very often was my philosophy, was my practice. And I would abuse them really loudly, insult them, I'd either punch them or kick them between their legs or do something really insulting and rude. And every single man I ever did it to, and I don't blame them, they were kind of embarrassed and shocked and didn't do a thing, except one guy in Harringay in North London. He was in this Greek section, he was sitting very tall, eating his fish and chips. And he said something like that. I walked across the road and I punched him in the nose, his fish and chips went flying, you know? I remember. But then he got mad at me and he started running down the street. He's chasing me. And then he got me and he punched me back. My glasses broke, my earrings broke. But it was really fascinating. I didn't get upset at all. I felt great respect for him. He was the first person who replied to me. Because I did in fact hurt him. I punched him. So can you imagine if I burst into tears and said, "How dare you punch me?" The guys in the shop sort of laughed. They were being, "You deserve it. You punched him. We saw it." Well, Buddha says there's a couple of lies between punching. That's the trouble. So for me, even that spirit was so funny. I didn't get upset at all. I thought, well done, congratulations. You had luck trying to beat me back, you know. It's a very funny experience. I had no resentful at all. Do you understand? Well, so Evan got caused it. I punched him first. Except there's never a first punch. Sorry, can't find a first punch. I'm giving me punches. So this view of compassion is not possible. That's how in our world we only have compassion for innocent victims, because that's our philosophy. That means compassion has to be the dynamic of an innocent victim and a monster. And the more the monster, the more compassion for the victim, and the more anger and rage against the person who did it to them. This is not the logic we have. And none of this is criticism, it's simply analysis, you know? So the Buddha view is different. That's all. We're all in the same boat, all minds are beginningless. All men have countless times, all harmed, loved, and hated each other countless times. I know it sounds hilarious. And it's a natural law. Whoever I meet, whatever they do, whatever I see, whatever I taste, whatever I smell, how it impacts upon me, I'm the main cause of it. I'm the main cause of the environmental karma, how it impacts upon me. I'm the main cause of how other people treat me, see me, hate me, love me, kill me, rape me, whatever. I'm the cause of all the goodness, the love, the compassion, the kindness, too. I'm the cause of all my own tendencies, and I'm even the cause of my own humanity. That's life. That's nothing left. I'm the boss. I'm the creator. And there's history between us. Intense, dynamic history. So I'm going to finish. I'm going to now get to your answer. Finally, get to my answer. I'm almost there. I'll get to it. Then a question. So, in that dynamic, it's very hard to have compassion for a person who's harmed. You've got to have a logic for it, and I don't think there's much logic for it in the materialist view. There might be because you're a really nice person, but there's not much logic in the materialist philosophical view of being an innocent victim who gets beaten or abused or harmed by a person, especially if you've never met them before, if they're kind of a stranger in your life, but maybe even more if you care, you know? So that's really hard for a person to heal through that, and very often people can't forgive. I know people talking about to people on death row, and people, fathers of somebody who had been murdered. He said he went through all this process, but he said he still couldn't quite forgive. And I can't see a reason to forgive if my philosophy is a materialist philosophy. But there's no logic to why it happened. Therefore, there's no logic, except, and this is the point now, this is the one point I can see if we're materialists. Sorry, I'll say that in a minute. If we're Christian, there's a logical reason to forgive because we believe God's in everybody, and God has a plan. I know people hate that view, but I think it's profound. If you can live that way, at least it enables you to let go and have forgiveness. I heard when we did a conference in America, and there was a particular piece in this happiness conference. It was about restorative justice, where the victims meet the victim. The victims meet the criminal or the family, and they all work and talk. And this is often in many cultures. They use this to heal problems instead of just going to prison, you know. So this one man, who happened to be black, and one woman, a Christian, who happened to be white, each of them, their children had been murdered, you know. The white one, the mother became a Christian and she wanted to meet the boy. And the black one, he's my friend Andre, he works in prisons. And so he was interested, he was interviewed on the television, he's a Buddhist. On the night of his murder, his son was stabbed to death in a bar. And he was asked, "How do you feel about the boy who killed your son?" He was in tears. He said, "How can I not have compassion for him? His suffering has only just started. And because he wasn't a young man in prison, you know, the boy was a young man. So, and he was in tears, he was really moving, it was really spontaneous, you know, it was so shocking for ordinary people. And the mother, the Christian mother, she went to meet this boy, and he was a white boy, he was out of his brain on drugs. He was so happy to meet her and all the things. But he told her what happened with the daughter. He was out of his brain, she was 16, he raped her, then he felt convinced he had to kill her as well, you know. So he killed her. And he said, before he killed her, the daughter looked him in the eye, and she said, one or the other, whichever order, I can't remember. God, I forgive you, and God does too. So whatever her view was. So the point I'm now getting to is this. Whether you're a Christian, a Muslim, a Buddhist, or a peanutist, I don't care. If we could look at our mind and observe the pain of rage, of blame, of resentment, of fear, of anger, of guilt. If we could just see, forget who did it to us, forget all the external details, but to look in isolation at oneself, at the nightmare of our own pain, that should be enough to forgive. The person doesn't have to know. Keep it to yourself. It should be enough. That's the point the Buddha's making first. Forget the grand gestures of forgiving to the person themselves. Forget love and compassion for the person. Forget that. Just recognize the pain, the loss, the pain, the grief, the despair of the states of mind themselves, the harm it's doing to me. So it's like self-respect, and that's what regret is. Recognizing this pain is unbearable, not to mention the pain I might have in the future if I think of karma. So the first step's like forgiving myself for the harm I've done. Owning it. It's like that. They don't use that word. So now I go to the second step and I recognize I'm heartbroken because of the suffering I caused. So now I can have compassion for those I've harmed. And then if I'm brave enough, I can have compassion for my father who harmed me, for the rapist, whoever, because I've got karmic connection with them. I know that I'm one of the cooperative causes for my past actions to have the dynamic to meet them again, and I'm one of the cooperative causes for them harming me. It's a huge one, but if I can do that, then the compassion in this case isn't anything to do with being an innocent victim. Because in one sense, Buddha says there's not a single thing such as an innocent victim. We're all conspiring in the same thing, life after life after life after life. So then, in my mind, in my father's death, of course, I'll have compassion for him, and then you could say, I will easily be able to forgive him. Easily, because I've got compassion. So, compassion in Buddhist terms, Justin, kind of encompasses forgiveness. It implies the person's suffering, and I understand why they did it, because they're driven by their delusions, their insanity, their psychosis, their craziness, and can I only imagine the nightmare in their mind. But meanwhile, if they're alive, I will put them in prison, no problem. See, compassion, when we think of compassion as for an innocent victim, it's kind of like sentimental compassion. The poor, and then as soon as we think I have to have compassion for an evil person, oh, you mean you get him off the hook? No! On the contrary, you protect him and put him in bloody prison, stop him from harming other people. So compassion is not sentimental compassion, it's like compassion with powerful wisdom and intelligence. Can you hear that point?
I'm hearing that anyone is not Buddhist.
What's
that
about?
Excuse me. Everyone is not Buddhist is condemned to hell, and Buddhism has the answer. That's how I'm
I really can't hear you at all. What did you say?
Am I not? What you've said, and I just want to reiterate it,
just to be clear.
Christianity falls a tad short. Buddhism shows a whole lot of accountability.
Yeah.
More so than maybe other religions.
It's okay. So what do you understand from what I'm telling you? What do you understand here?
I put the question out there.
What did I?
With some ideas in mind of personal experiences.
I'm losing you, Justin. You've got to say to me again. You said before something like, it seems to me that according to Buddhism, everybody who listens to Buddhism is condemned to hell. Is that what you said?
Yes,
you've got to unpack that. So try and unpack the concept there. What does that? I mean, that's got nothing to do with what I just said, though.
All right.
So I know where you got that from.
The person who jumped into me, okay, they should go to jail.
I want to understand what you're saying.
Whoever harmed one particular person, okay, they've committed a crime,
that's right.
They've created harm.
Yes.
They go to jail.
That's
that situation.
You asked me what it means, I tried to explain it, but we don't want to use that phrase. So what if you understood, try to say what you think I just said in summary, and then we can debate about it and see if you've got an accurate understanding of what I said. Okay, so if I harm you and I steal from you, that's inappropriate. It's called immoralism. It's wrong, isn't it? Do you accept that? I accept that's immoral. Buddhism is all about ethics. Don't kill, don't lie, don't steal, don't harm. That's fundamental starting point of junior school grade one Buddhist practice. Don't harm even an ant. Don't harm even a worm. Can you hear those words?
That's clear.
That's clear. That's a starting point in Buddhist practice. Don't harm any living being. First step, as much as you can, refrain from harming sentient beings. Okay, can you hear that?
So no retribution.
The retribution implies a person who does it. This is now I'm understanding what you're saying. It takes time to hear the concept of karma, but I'd like to suggest that you're misconstruing it. You're hearing it in the same way that the concept of punishment and reward. Buddha is saying that karma is like botany. You sow a seed in the ground, it is natural law that at a certain point it will produce a fruit, isn't it? You accept that logic. Buddha is saying that the concept of karma is exactly like that when it comes to minds. That everything I do and say and think naturally sows seeds in my mind that will bring their own results. There's no punishment and there is no reward. That's an impossibility because there is no punisher and rewarder. It is a natural law that every moment of kindness I receive at the hands of others, every goodness I receive, every bit of generosity, everybody who likes me, who treats me well, all my own good tendencies, all the good things that happen to me, every single one of these is the fruit of my past actions. I am the one who literally creates myself. By my virtuous actions in the past, they will produce future happiness of mine. No one does it to me. There's no person running the show or judging or rewarding. There is no such dualistic concept in Buddhism. And every moment of suffering that I experience is the fruit of the actions that I've done in the past that are labeled negative. That's the simple principle. But it's zero to do with punishment and reward. Because there's no such person as a punisher or a rewarder. That concept takes a while to hear, I would suggest.
Thank you.
Is that enough for now?
Yeah, probably.
Doesn't matter, just everybody has the same discussion. It's perfect, yeah. It's good, so keep saying. So what's the question from that? Why did you deduce that therefore every non-Buddhist is condemned to hell forever? Why did you say that dramatic, extreme statement based on what I said?
I'm praying for that. It seems like a greater level of accountability in the Buddhist faith, maybe.
Don't say faith, say Buddhist philosophy. Buddhist observations about reality.
Thank you. It seems to me that's the case.
Yes.
A greater level of accountability.
That's the only one there is to have because we are the cause of all our own experiences, Buddha says.
Yep.
All the good and all the bad. So when I know that, that's why I wouldn't want to kill them now, because I don't want future suffering. And when I know I want to be generous and kind now, because I want future happiness. And then when I go beyond that, I'll start to have more compassion for others because we're all in the same boat. That's the next step. That's the one that's more profound, the compassion one. Because we're all in the same boat. So the rapist of this life was the rape of the past life. And the giver of this life was the one who receives it. It's simply like it, speaking like that way. It's a huge, outrageous concept, I understand exactly, but it's got nothing to do with punishment and reward, because there's no punisher and there's no reward. In just the same way, you go to the doctor and she says, don't smoke, you might get cancer. You do not accuse her of punishing you with cancer, do you? Because it's absurd to think that, because you know it's a natural law that cancer is a consequence of smoking. Well, suffering is a consequence of negative actions, Buddha says. But we find it hard to hear, because we come from a very strong, dualistic, punitive view of punishment and reward. So it's hard to hear it in a fresh way. It takes time to process it.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
I'm wondering about karma. I think I had the wrong idea about it, because when you were talking about guilt, I kind of had this idea that it was kind of this inbuilt kind of result. I've done something bad, so the karma is that therefore I suffer through these kind of regretful feelings.
No, this is what we impose on it. No, that is suffering, it's true. Guilt is terrible suffering. That's not the real point, no. No.
Right.
It's like a technical point. Everything you think you do and say sow seeds.
Yeah.
So to bring future suffering. If you eat poison, you're going to get future bellyache.
Yeah, that poison is a direct consequence of you eating that, in the same way that me being awful to someone and feeling guilty, they're direct consequences.
Oh, that, yeah, the way we feel bad is also a consequence. That's not the only consequence.
Right.
The real one of why we want to regret having done that bad action to my boyfriend is because I just sowed a seed in my mind that will ripen as my suffering like that in the future. So then I would want to regret it out of a healthy way and then have compassion for him, and that helps shift my mind and change, reconfigure the whole process in my mind. We're always talking about his thoughts.
Yeah.
How's that?
Yeah. Another question.
Yeah, sure.
You step through the karmic ripening steps of killing or not killing.
Yeah.
What about when it comes to natural phenomena like death by earthquake or disease,
yeah, that's called environmental karma.
Right.
Okay, so the four ways karma would ripen for killing, I did non-killing before, but just extrapolate. You'd be born in a suffering type of rebirth. You'd have or if you're born a human, you have a tendency to kill. You'd get killed or you die young. Or the fourth one is called environmental karma, and that's the natural disasters and environmental illnesses and pollution and that kind of thing. And there's all these explanations of it in the more esoteric teachings, which could sound so abstract initially, it sounds so bizarre to us in fact. But this is reaffirming the point that Buddha says really all sentient beings collectively and individually are the creators of our reality. It sounds so cosmic initially, it's really hard to kind of hear it, you know? Yeah. Okay. What else? I was going to do the practice, but now it's time to bed, I think. Mm. Change the line. So, yeah, stuff takes time. And it takes time, yeah. And many people can't stand these calls. In fact, all I'm doing is my job to tell you about the Buddha's view, which is what I'm buying into, trying to live according to, trying to comprehend, trying to utilize, see if it works. So far so good, what to say to me, so far so good. I know when I first heard the teaching about karma, when I first went to my first teaching, it was really that was one that struck me. It was like a revelation actually, huge for me. It always just seemed so insane that innocent victims would get hurt. There's no logic to any of that. For me that's a recipe for real insanity, which is how the world is. We're full of this bizarre, I mean no wonder we're living in fear. If you never know, if there's no law that runs it, if there's no law that runs the universe, I'm not talking about a creator. If there's no law, which we assume there isn't, or that we haven't discovered it yet, then no wonder we live here. You never know what bad things, we never know when bad things are going to happen. That's why we think everything is good luck and bad luck. So we just have to kind of put up with it. I mean, that for me is a nightmarish philosophical view to have. I'd rather have an explanation, like karma, and be prepared to work with it, and then indeed I'll find it's wrong one day, I'll be happy and enjoy myself on the way. I'm trying to think it through. This seems irrational and insane and nihilistic to me that suffering and happiness can be random. That's how we believe in the West. It's astonishing in my mind. Just bad things happen. No one knows why. We're all born this way. What to do? That's kind of torture, in my opinion. Anyway, we're all different minds, I mean. We take it for granted. Except bad things happen. No one knows why. That's like saying, no one knows gardens. Just bad things grow. Good things grow. No one knows why. There's no law. Like, no one's discovered botany, you know? The world would be chaos. Trees eating all the buildings, overcoming everything, coming up to the floor. Oh, just the way like it. We know botany, so we can harness gardens. We know laws of mathematics, so we can harness things. We can build 100-story buildings without them falling over, because we learn the law of math, law of engineering, law of architecture. We haven't got the laws of happiness and suffering there at all, it seems to me. We're living in chaos and fear and panic and anger and rage and blame and guilt. God almighty, what a nightmare. The Buddha's view is of fixing your mind, changing your actions. You produce your own happiness and liberation from insanity. It's a logical, incremental, and natural mental process. It's a job done by the mind. Karma's done by the mind. And the mind is what experiences the results of it. That's it. We are made by ourselves, we're the same. So there's no punishment. There's no reward. There's no retribution that implies a person doing it to you. Got to think that through. That's shocking. So when bad things have happened to us, it's a very heavy one to hear. But when good things happen, we don't care. That's the point. We take it for granted. And that's why, you know, I think of all the things in my life, my daddy did this and that, and my rabbis did this and that, but far more good things have happened to me. But we don't ever think about why good things happen. Don't you get reward? Yeah, your own happiness. You created it, baby. But we just take it for granted. We really just want more happiness, more goodness, more rewards, please. But retribution, blame, punishment, suffering, no thanks, I don't deserve. It's very fascinating. The assumption I do deserve happiness. For me, even that's an interesting philosophical point. We assume we deserve happiness, but don't deserve suffering. I think that's a mistake. We want happiness, and we don't want suffering. That's valid. But to extrapolate to say deserve, that's just demented. That's like looking in your bank. Well, how come there are no dollars in my bank? I deserve dollars. You would never say that, because you know it's your bank account. So what's in there is what you put there. Well, you don't say, who put weeds in my garden? It's your garden. So Buddha basically says, our life is our garden. And whatever is in it, I put there. It's mine, we own it. Power and encouragement and optimism and wisdom and compassion comes from that. That's Buddhism. We have such compassion for every single being on the planet, because we're all walking around like mad people, not knowing why we're suffering, not knowing why we're happy, creating more suffering as we go. Demented, schizophrenic, insane, the mental suffering of just humans, forget the poor animals, is like beyond bearing. They say when you really get advanced spiritually, your compassion is so unbearable. The suffering for the suffering of all sentient beings. Unbearable suffering, all sentient. That only comes from seeing your own thirst and then opening our eyes to others. All demented, running around like crazy people, harming and being harmed, trying to get happiness, don't know how to get it, lost. Blah, blah. Time to go. So, yeah. If you can be silent, like retreat mode for the evening, if you can, if you want to be silent, it's nice to think about what you've heard, you know, look at the sky, if you can see the sky out there. Write a little journal, contemplate, meditate on what we've heard today, process it. Then when you go to sleep, make a decision to see your, make a decision to see your dreams as dreams. It's very auspicious. See your dreams as dreams. May I see my dreams. Not remember your dreams when you wake up, that's okay. But as you're dreaming, be conscious you're dreaming, because your subtle mind is more powerful. It's very tasty. Just see if you can do that. Before you go to sleep. May I see my dreams as dreams. And the next bit is if you, when you wake up in the morning, be delighted you woke up, because you could have died. It's not like a joke to us. We're all impermanent. And one of the mistakes Buddha makes, says we all make, is we think we're permanent. Of course I'm going to die tomorrow, I'll say. So be in the silence if you feel like, and before you have a meditation in the morning, and a cup of breakfast, chat away then, it's all right. Because the morning, the evening and the morning can be silent, retreat mode. Make an aspiration to see your dreams as dreams. Wake up in the morning, the memory is still alive and delight. To make the aspiration to hop out of bed, use a meditation, take a breakfast, come to the class, learn a few more things that might be useful to us, to take as tools, to help us develop our amazing potential. Something in your bed, something like that. Jamto, Sento Rinpoche, Ma Kye Panam Kye Yuchi, Kye Panyampa Me Payam Vom Me Gong Du, Kava Sho, Kye Wadi Nyuru Dang, Lama Sangye Druk Yune, Drawa Chikyang Marupa, Jay Sala Kapa Sho. Thank you, people.
Thank you.
Relax. Meditate. Sleep. Enjoy. Shut up. Thank you.